So everybody, welcome to the panel. If you guys want to move up, feel free. There's
or move back.
Or move back.
I've been known to projectile vomit, so you might want to bring...
I am happy to be here already. So this is a Q&A panel. Any questions you guys have, just raise your hand and we'll try and go one at a time. Anybody got any questions to start us off?
I have one.
Okay, Mr. Darrell.
Do you have to trim that fairly often?
I just pull it out.
Is it a lot of work?
What's that?
Is it a lot of work?
No, it's not a lot of work. It smells like my dog after a
while. What, any particular breed? As long as it's not Chihuahua, I think you're probably...
Newfie.
You're probably okay.
Anybody to start us off, or am I breaking the ice? Yes, Mr. DeCourcy.
I'm just wondering about your guys, how do you guys work? Like, do you guys set times? How is it that you guys kind of plan your day, I guess?
Who wants to go first?
He's a real artist.
Okay.
I've got a family. When I was single, I would work all through the night, sleep during the day, and really flexible just whenever I felt like working or not. But once I got married and started raising kids, it's really hard to do that. Because your wife has a schedule, your kids need you at a certain time, so I started trying to work regular hours, 9 to 5. So I have a pretty normal day. I get up fairly late, I guess 7:30 or 8, somewhere around there, and start to work and try to quit by 6. So pretty banker's hours.
I'm just kind of the same thing, except that I can't sleep late anymore. I wake up at like 4:30 or 5 in the morning.
Wow.
And I work from 5 until around 6 at night. And, I generally work about, doesn't seem like I get much done, but I work, 6 or 7 days a week. I just get bored sitting around. And my wife is French, and I like to watch, my daughter's the age where she likes to watch movies, but my wife's like, oh, she spent too much time in front of the television, and, so we only get like an hour and a half we can watch TV together.
Yeah. You end up working a lot of weekends for some reason, either just because we like our jobs, we like working, or because you're on a deadline. So I used to have days where I'd work all night trying to meet a deadline or something. I really hate to do that anymore, so I try to avoid that. But a lot of times I'll work in the evening or over the weekends.
Now, do you have a pace that you try to set for when you have an actual deadline? I try to get one page done in X amount of time?
Well, you try to plan it out so you're not going to be doing 12 pages over the weekend to meet that deadline.
Yeah.
You try to budget your time and keep on a schedule, sure, which is a lot harder than you might think because not every page is the same. Some pages take more time than other pages. And things come up, especially when you have kids. You got a ball game or whatever might come up where you got to have family time. So it's hard to juggle your time. And in the old days, prime of my career, they were very strict about deadlines. They really frowned on someone that couldn't keep a monthly schedule. Seemed to have loosened up quite a bit in the last decade or so, and I see a lot of miniseries. I see a lot of... I know personally a lot of artists that only do 2 or 3 issues a year, which was unheard of, in my heyday. So I don't know.
Okay, you and the baseball cap.
Yeah. Have you ever, when you were working on a deadline and you were coming up to that deadline, had to sort of whiff on some panels or on a page because you had to hit the deadline, or would that be something that you'd work through the night to get done?
Yeah, I mean, I try to keep a certain standard of my work. I haven't always met that standard, and I regretted it whenever I didn't. Anything you rush through, probably regret the rest of your life. So I try to keep a certain standard and never make it apparent to anybody but myself that I'm rushing. And there's tricks to doing that, fewer backgrounds or, fewer, less detail or whatever, fewer small figures. Anything that takes more time, you try to just cut corners and work your way around those. But yeah, more often than not, I've had to do that because, like I say, deadlines, that's been the one frustration with my career, really, is deadlines. I never felt like I could do my best work, just whatever your best is by Friday. You know, so if I had it to do over again, I would do a lot more. Hell with the deadline. You know, I'll go work someplace else and just do my best work more. But in the early days, I felt if I did that, they wouldn't hire me. You know, so I was more worried about just keeping employed.
Next question.
I've never. I mean, the only time I've ever been up against deadlines and I've had to is what I do work for hire with like covers and stuff. But on the comics that I've done, I've never, because I started out in Europe and over there. I mean, if you do 2 books a year, which is 40 some pages, then you are really rolling. And most people would do 1.
Yeah.
And I know when I was working with Frank Miller on this Hardball thing, there was like there's a big gap between the second and third one, and everybody said, "Well, it's late." And I was like, "No, no, it's not," because I was working on a European thing. I mean, I admire you so much because I've never been able to. I could never do it. I'm just, especially now, I'm too spoiled. But even then,
we've really had totally different kinds of careers in the type of stuff we do, so there's not a lot of cross.
That's what I was just going to mention.
I've been, you know, incredibly lucky in that. I don't know how I've managed to make a living because I don't do that much. I always managed to stumble into something where they were going to pay me a certain amount of money for, you know, not a lot of work.
That's the thing. I've seen a lot of your pages that. So much detail and little figures and little cars and robots or whatever, and it would take me I don't know how many days to draw a page like that, and I would have missed my deadline.
I'm lucky because Frank, when I was working with Frank, when I started doing Hardball, we didn't have a publisher. He said, "Well, I'll pay you." He said, "I'll give you X amount of dollars a month." And after 2 months, he goes, "I can't keep paying." And so that's when they found a publisher. And I said, "Well, I don't know, Frank. You know, you gotta do more. You gotta do more." And we were 2 different kinds of artists. I mean, we're so polar opposites. But
next question, yes, sir.
So, what are you guys working on right now?
I just got a call like 2 days ago from DC. They want me to ink a new penciler who needs a little help. Most of my career I was kind of known as a finisher. I could help out the rougher pencils and give them a certain look. And so this new penciler is the son of Neil Adams, Josh Adams. And it's one of his first jobs. It's just a little 10-page job. And it's kind of ironic because Neil Adams got me my start in comics. When I was up trying to show my work around, try to get a foot in the door, Neil made a call to Marvel Comics and got me a job over there as my first job. So kind of nice.
Kind of full circle in those regards.
Yeah. But I haven't started that yet, coming up.
Jeff.
I'm signing in the... I haven't done a comic in a few years. I'm doing Shaolin Cowboy, but I spent the last couple of years trying to do this animated version of this comic I do called Shaolin Cowboy. I was in Japan for about a year and a half trying to get it finished, which was more difficult than you can possibly imagine. Because Japan, they're not, you know, I don't can't blame them. There's like suddenly you get this big goofy white guy that comes in there, and as they told me, they said, I asked them, I said, "Well, how do people think of me here?" And they said, "Well, many Japanese are afraid of foreigners, and you're a very big foreigner." So I, you know, finally that sort of finished that, and I think then the situation over there now really finished it off. But so now I'm back to the long story short, I'm drawing Shaolin Cowboy, and it's going to be at Dark Horse Comics. And amazing, they have 40 pages, which for me is quite a
accomplishment.
It has to be colored, and I've managed to find a colorist who's probably as slow as I am.
You say that with pride.
you know, like, actually, I'll be like, come on, man, speed it up. Yeah.
Actually, that slides into a question I had about Shell and Cowboy. I was lucky enough to talk to a guy you've collaborated with a couple times, Andrew Vax, about 3 months ago. Four months ago. And he mentioned a Shell and Cowboy prose novel that he has written that you're doing illustrations to.
He wrote 2 years ago. Because, do you know who Andrew Vax is? He's an attorney.
Amazing crime writer.
Yeah, and an amazing person. I mean, he does a lot of work for abused kids and abused his wife, Alice, who's a special prosecutor. Have you ever seen that show, SVU, Law and Order? That's her. I mean, and she's an amazing woman. But anyway, you know, he's just a very serious and amazing gentleman. And I were talking, and I said, I've never written anything. It's just for fun. It always has a purpose to it. I said, would you ever? He goes, well, you know, what do you mean? I said, well, you know, like Shaolin Cowboy, would you write a story? He goes, would you let me? And I said, yeah. And he goes, I'd love to do that. So he, of course, the thing with him is I thought, well, you know, he'll do it in, I don't know, 5 years or something. And like 2 months later, the thing is finished. And it's been 2 years. And we've got the cover and I have to do this. And it's going to be printed like a pulp magazine, like a real pulp magazine with the illustrations and similar paper. And so it'll be but it's a very different thing for him. And he's an amazing guy.
I can concur from the interview I did with him.
He's the closest thing, I think, to like almost, I don't know what to say, like Spock, but he will, if you say, how you doing? He'll tell you, he'll give you his temperature. I mean, if you say, like, oh, you know, well, you know, I got this, man, what's the matter? I go, I'm drinking this water, it's a little too cold. You regulate your water heater, it's probably, there's probably a gasket missing on the second floor. But I just.
Yes, sir.
Bob told us how he broke in. How did you break in, Jeff?
It's all sort of backdoor. I remember I think it was Dick Giordano, who was at DC, and I showed him my work, and he looked at it and he goes, it's really good, but I wouldn't know what to do with it. And years went by, and I had met, because I'm a big fan of Jean Giraud, who's also known as Mobius, and I was living in Los Angeles, and I found out he was working on Tron. And I had a friend that was like a project manager at Disney, and I would call him up, and I said, hey, there's this guy working there. And I just, if I could meet this guy, just want to shake his hand. He's like, no one had ever seen him in the States. I mean, he's just like very, this is the early 80s. And he called me back and said, oh, yeah, we're having dinner with him. And I thought, I can't be the same guy. Yeah, but it was him, and we hit it off, and we went out to dinner a few times, and he said, what do you do? And I said, oh, I draw. He goes, really? I said, well, yeah, sort of, I try. He asked to see what I did, and he really liked it, and then he said, you know, you should, you know, try and, you know, do comics, you know, because he was with Metal, Herland, which is heavy metal in France, and I went over there and showed him my stuff, and I started in comics in Europe. And through Mobius, oddly enough, Mobius was living in Los Angeles, and I was in Los Angeles, and he said, oh, he goes, Jeff, Frank Miller's coming over to my house, would you like to meet him? And I said, yeah, sure, yeah, because he, and so I go over there, of course I show up, and Mobius forgot about it, and wasn't there, but Frank was, with his wife Lynn Varley, and that's how we got to be friends, and then later on, Frank asked me to work with him, which was fairly amazing. So I worked in Europe with probably the leading guy, which put me on the map over there, and then I worked with Frank. Nobody knew who I was here. Probably regret what they do now. So I'm very lucky.
Which do you prefer, working over there or the American way? Because they're pretty different.
My biggest problem is that when I was over there, they said, oh, you're a little too American. And over here, they said, oh, you're a little too European. I was like caught in the middle. And then when I went to Japan, that was a whole other story. But I don't know. I don't know. You know, I'm just lucky that people let me draw, you know, what I want to draw.
Yes, sir, you at the back.
Just because you're talking about your experience in Europe and everything, there are certain, you know, comic artists that somebody who's just a reader or whatever, or just, you know, a casual follower, will say, they look like, you know, they look similar, there's something similar. And I'm just thinking of Druyer, D-R-U-I-L.
Yeah, Druyer, yeah.
Did you know his stuff at all? Or
he was one of those guys. He's Bud Plant. You know, Bud Plant books is like, in the early 70s, he was the only guy that was importing stuff.
Yeah.
And it was cheap, you know, French albums. And I'd seen, and Maurice Horn had done a book on the history of comics, and he had printed comics from all over the world, and he had drawings from Druyer and Hermann and Mobius and Giraud. And I sent for them like a dollar a piece, and I bought them. I mean, I couldn't read them, but I was fascinated by the artwork. And Mobius has always talking to Druyer, kind of, you know, he's, I don't know. Him and Mobius used to be really big rivals. There's a funny story about that. But, and Mobius is, for me, is like my... Do you know Alejandro Jodorowsky? You ever heard of him?
Yeah.
Well, the first time I went to a comic convention, it was in Angoulême, and they introduced me to Jodorowsky, and he'd seen my work. And the first words out of his mouth, he said to me, excuse the language, Daro, why do you want to fuck your father? Because I was working with Mobius on this thing called City of Fire, and I said, he will eat you alive. I don't even know the guy. So, anyway, I go on. Boring story.
Next question? Anyone? Yes, sir.
This is to Bob particularly. You're known for a lush inking style, and you brought that for years in your career. Hey, are you starting to incorporate any new digital tools or any of those things into your work, or are you still working in the traditional fashion?
I've tried digital inking, and it just seems like a gimmick that's really not any easier. It's actually much harder, at least for me, it's much harder. I can't see any purpose in it, so I do digital coloring, and I will scan my work in and fiddle around with it because it's just fun to play in Photoshop. But I still like penciling on paper. Even I like hand lettering, really. I learned how to letter back in art school, and I worked in production department at Marvel for a while and learned how to letter comic books from a couple of Marvel's letterers. And it's just so much fun, I think, and it gives a personality to the lettering that you don't get with a comic font. And I'm still a pencil and paper guy.
So. Well, so John Workman had said that he's starting to letter digitally, but he's lettering by hand digitally. He's starting like he's lettering for again, but it's he's gone back to doing it with a stylus by hand rather than.
Yeah, I've done that too. Yeah. I mean, it's just to me, touching a pencil to paper is a different tactile experience than a digital tablet. And then, you know, they both have their charms, but there's something about inking with a brush on paper. It's just, to me, it's a sensual thing. I mean, it's just really great that you can't duplicate with a digital tablet.
Which brush is your primary choice?
Well, I used to like the old Winsor Newton Series 7, number 3. I would use the number 3. But something's happened. It's not as good as it used to be. I don't know what
everyone
they changed.
Feels that way, I think, yeah.
And so now everybody uses the Raphael 8404, so I gave that a try, and that's what I generally use now. I don't love it. I think that might have even influenced the way inking changed, because it's a thicker, stiffer point, and it's easier to do that little stubby feathering that everybody likes to do now. Whereas when I learned to ink, Bernie Wrightson was an influence, and Frazetta, and they had these long sweeping strokes that I like to do, and you could do with a Winsor Newton, but you can't do that with a Raphael. The ink's not as good as it used to be. The paper's not as good as you used to be able to do these long flowing strokes. If you try to do that now, the ink is too dry or the brush is too stiff and it breaks up the line. You don't get that. So you have to dilute the ink, which is okay, but even the ink, it's just not what it used to be. So maybe that's just, you know, me getting used to certain things, and somebody coming in today would prefer the new stuff. I don't know. But
I don't think so. That's the feedback a lot of people are saying in those kind of questions.
Yeah, even the pinpoints. I used to use a pinpoint called a Jalop 290, which is what Neil Adams used. A lot of the inkers around that time were using. That was a fantastic pinpoint, a ProQuil type pinpoint. It's flexible, lets you get a thick and thin line. And I could do anything with that pinpoint, and then they discontinued it. And so I had to find some new point, and there just hasn't been another point like that that I've found since then.
Next question? Oh, yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I have a question for Bob. Your work is very recognizable as a fan, you know, over the years, reading comics since I was 7 years old. And it was just mentioned, like, you're a finisher. And I was always curious, as there are some, you know, inkers who seem to do more than trace. In your experience, what is it that you fix? Is it the anatomy of the pencil that's not as good, or is it backgrounds? Or exactly what does an inker do to a penciler who doesn't do the complete job, either because of time or because of their...
Well, it's not usually that they don't do a complete job, although it can be. John Buscema, one of the best artists ever to work, would almost do... it was like inking dot to dot. It was so unfinished. He would put little pieces of a line instead of just a line. So you're having to connect those lines. And he wouldn't put any blacks in, wouldn't put any rendering in. He's basically storytelling. He'd decide how many panels, what's in the panel, you know, what pose the character's in and everything. But then everything after that was up to the inker. So that's one thing where the finisher would finish the art. But then there were these pencilers who were just, in their style, were really rough. And again, back in the 70s, 80s, the penciler's job was just to tell the story. And then they would bring in the inker to add style and make it printable. So it wasn't anything, it wasn't looked like a disadvantage to have loose pencils. They want to do for their storytelling ability, posing the figures, you know, setting the scene and everything. And then they would find an inker who could make it look good if it wasn't polished. And then there were inkers, and then there were pencilers who just weren't very good. And you had to, like you say, fix their anatomy, fix their perspective. I've redrawn entire panels. If they do too many medium shots, you know, I just get bored, so I just erase it and put in a close-up or a long shot or something to break the storytelling.
Did you ever get caught doing that? They might have
complained to the editor, but they didn't complain
and
to me.
You?
Yeah.
That's a sort of follow-up question. You're almost the last guy in the chain. Wow.
Almost, but not quite. The colorist.
No, true, but the jobs after you are really quick and close to the deadline usually, right? The inker is like the last major guy to touch it. So did you have a lot of, over time, did you have a lot of leeway in terms of just getting the job done and the editor wouldn't give you crap?
No, this guy was asking about stuff like deadlines. The writer has all the time in the world. Penciler has usually a good chunk of time. The letterer less time. The inker less time. The colorist less time. Because those first two take so long, generally, they don't worry about down the line. The editor, I hear that they've gotten better about it in the 70s, 80s, 90s. They would schedule a book before they even found a writer and penciler and inker to do it. And then they'd have to, and so it just ended up getting, it was always late. now I think, at least I haven't experienced this, but I've heard that they will set up a team before they schedule it and get it rolling, maybe even get a book or two in the drawer before they put it on the print schedule. But yeah, I never got any extra time. I was always rush.
There he is.
Early in your career, Jeff, you did, you were inked by Mobius, but you tend to not collaborate artistically that much. Is there a reason for that, or would you like to, or what?
Well,
you've worked with writers, obviously.
Yeah, how? You mean have somebody ink?
Have you ever thought it'd be fun to just jam with somebody, or somebody pencils you inks, or vice versa? Or?
I'm like a caveman. I don't think I ink very well. I think I'd ruin whatever I would touch. I don't know. When I worked with Mobius, I did this thing called City of Fire, and I drew it. And there's one of them. He said he couldn't work on it more than 2 hours a day because it was just too much work. And I think he used it as a warm-up exercise. He said, get up in the morning, put your drawing down, do 2 hours, and then I'm ready to do blueberry. That guy is just. I remember this Italian artist named Silvio Cadello said, he's a monster. And he is kind of, because he could just, I think he could, if you gave him a turd, he'd turn it into, satin, because he's just, I don't think anybody would want to ink what I would do. I've known guys that have just done, and they hand it off to, an inker, and they've just gotten pissed and said there's too many backgrounds, and they've taken them out. And yikes, how can you do that, man? Jeepers. I'd get this thing done. And
so your pencils are pretty tight then when you go to ink?
Yeah, they're pretty. I'm really, because I don't, I don't think I draw very well. And I was thinking, if I don't get it, at least I'm going to mess it up with what little inking skills I have. So, because I've worked at Hanna-Barbera, and I had this boss that was always just telling me how lousy I was.
Sometimes you feel that way.
Pardon?
You do it for someone who has such confident amount of detail in your work.
That Hanna-Barbera guy.
He was really good. That guy could really, you never saw it on the screen, at least in the stuff I worked on in the 80s. But they had some of the most amazing artists work in there that could just draw like gods. And, but by the time it got back from, Taiwan, or they'd send it, at one point they were sending them to, I got a funny story about animation studio in Poland, it was just like so bad. You would never imagine that the quality of the drawing that went into it before it got to that stage. I digressed. But anyway, that guy was a good artist.
Any more questions? Anybody got anything? You new people at the back? That's right, I'm pointing you out.
Let me tell you this. I got to tell you the story about this pencil.
I was just going to ask.
This boggles the imagination. They decided they were going to do in between animation in Poland because they could do it cheap. I mean, Hanna-Barbera, Joe Barbera, or Bill Hanna was always trying to find things really cheap. So they set up the studio. They're doing the Smurfs over there, doing the in between. They go over there, and they've got one pencil sharpener, and it's not bolted down. It's like one of the crank ones. And so one guy would hold it, and they would, when they had to sharpen the pencil. So one guy's holding the pencil sharpener, while the other guy's turning the thing. And they said, you got to screw it to the table. Okay. So they screwed the table. He comes back, my friend comes back, and he says, they screwed it to the center of the table, so they handle it. And it's like,
So you would have to take the pencil out, drink once.
Yeah. I mean, it was mind-boggling. And I don't know what it was, you know.
That was a pretty good
one. But when I was in Paris, they had no electric pencil sharpeners. They thought I was nuts. I said, you know, they had a special order the thing. And it took like 6 weeks. The electric pencil sharpener. Pourquoi? Qu'est-ce que tu veux faire avec ça? What do you want to do with that? And it's, you know, oh, you need that. And they would, you know, they'd have a little, you know, it looked like half bidet. I think it was a half bidet, half pencil sharpener. In Paris, in the French, you go to, they do this, they like train noises. You go to the post office is always backed up. You walk into the post office, I go in, there's always a line. I go in, and every person that came into the door after me would walk into the door, stop, look at the line, and go, it was like the trains, everybody, the exact same.
Now, anybody have questions about Cold War Poland?
Or train stations in France?
Now, when you were at Hanna-Barbera, was Jack Kirby there at the same time you were?
Yes, and Jack would, every once in a while, because he didn't drive, and his wife drove him, because the story I heard was that when she was pregnant, he was driving her to the hospital. He went up the wrong exit, to get on the freeway, so they never let him drive again, so she would drive him. And he'd come in, he did character designs. And then have him working on Scooby-Doo, for God's sake. Except what he didn't understand was, you know, when you draw, you have to draw in that style. And Jack only drew in one style. So if he said, you know, we need, you know, Scooby, one episode was Scooby and Shaggy were Alice in Wonderland. And but you have to put him in costume, but Jack would just be like, he'd trace the faces, and then they'd just have, you know, the Jack Kirby bodies. and they were model sheets. So you'd have to draw them over, but he would come in. I remember one time he came in, and I was sitting there, he goes, hey, do you have a pencil? Can I borrow it? Oh, yeah. And sit down, and he'd draw up my desk. And he'd go, you know, he said, you got to come out to the house sometime. And went out there. Just the sweetest guy. I mean, the most unassuming and just wonderful. Gentlemen. Boy, you saw some funny drawings.
Now, Jeff's mentioned the fact that he's worked with some legendary people in the field. You worked with, for what was during the 80s, one of the best-known Marvel writers, with Chris Claremont. How was working on New Mutants with him?
Torture. Chris and I never really got along that well.
I don't think you're the only one.
I rode in a car with him once. That 3-hour ride was enough for me. Yeah. I mean, the ego, there's barely enough room to, you know, for me to breathe in the car.
Yeah. Chris has so many ideas. I mean, his writing, he's got a lot of fans. Obviously, people enjoy his writing. It's not what I like, but obviously, a lot of people do like it, but the main problem I had with him was he would give you like 50 pages of plot for a 22-page comic. So you either had to draw 12 panels a page, or just cut stuff out. And so when I worked with him, I was pretty new, some of my first penciling work, and I hated to just leave stuff out. You know, I wanted to respect what he had written. And it wasn't, you know, would have been fun stuff to draw. There just wasn't any room for it. So I ended up kind of having to edit myself and just throw things out the window because there wasn't any room for them. And Chris didn't mind. You know, he said he'd rather give me too much than not enough. Because I talked to him about it, and he said, no, go, you know, do what you will. And so I had to decide where to break the page, how many panels to put on the page, you know, and how to show everything. And it was just such a chore for me that early in my career to edit his script and then pencil it. So it was not fun working with Chris. And then he was so popular at the time, he had like so much power in the business, so you couldn't change anything. We could delete stuff, but you couldn't change anything. So I would, he would give, and he'd love to put balloons down at the bottom of the panel, so people were standing in the balloons, which I always hated. He would just cover up so much stuff. He would ask you to draw a crowd and then cover up most of it. So he'd spend hours drawing the stuff, and he'd cover it up with balloons. He put like 12 balloons in each panel. And so I would try to draw something, and then I managed to letter a couple jobs myself, so I'd be in control of that stuff. So I'd move. He'd have balloon placements. He'd say, I want a balloon here and here and here, and I would move them so I could show my art there, and it fit nicely other places. And then he and the editor come like, "Whoa, this has to be here. This, you know, changes my whole effect here if you put this balloon here instead of here." And, you know, the editor says, you know, Chris has a reason for everything he does. I said, well, I have a reason for everything I do, too. So we worked together less and less after that.
I remember I was in London, and they were given, or the convention, they gave away those Eagle Awards or whatever.
Yeah.
And he was there, and he won. When they announced the nomination and his name came up, people booed. Because there was that sort of backlash. And when he won, they booed him, which was pretty. And I was like, oh, man. And he got up, and I thought, he got up, and he won up, and he got the award, and he gave an acceptance speech with these people booing him. And I was like, wow, this guy, you know. I would have just been, you know, like,
mail sort of grab and run.
Mail the thing. I'm not going up there. But it didn't seem to, you know, I don't know what he was thinking, but it seemed to phase him out.
I think he's a little oblivious, really. Yeah. There's a few people in comics, almost everybody in comics is very nice. There's a few people whose egos just don't fit through the door quite.
And I know one that worked with Mr. Claremont quite a bit. John Byrne, my God, he's an amazing, amazing fellow. Remember when we were doing this, we had this whole group of artists, there's this thing called, goofy name, Legend, and we all went to Portland, and John came, and we're all in this room, and he goes, I've got a treat for you guys, and he's got this videotape. And it's a videotape film of his home, a tour of his house. And, you know, and we're supposed to watch this thing, and you go, no, and then the camera's panning around, and here's my Lincoln letter, and this is my, you know, and he's just showing all this stuff. I'm like, oh my God. And it went on for like 25 minutes. Later on we go to New York, and we're in New York, and he wants us all, it was the middle of a big blizzard, he wants us all to come to his house. He's going to give us a tour. And he goes, Jeff, we're going to have a tour. You come to my house? I said, no, I saw the video. He got really mad.
I'm glad I got to do this panel. This is awesome.
Oh, man. Yeah, boy, some of the stuff that went on, boy, some of the fights that went on between some of those, because whether it been Frank Miller and John, and they were the two, you know, giants in the room, and Frank got along pretty well with Chris, but there were some of the other guys in Legend that were just and John just, you know, it had to be his way. I mean, he's just, if it wasn't his way, then it wasn't going to happen. I remember Mignola telling him to, why don't you climb up on your cross and die, Jesus? Mike is a wonderful guy. You push him, man. He'll just die on your cross and your big, giant, Modoc-sized head and die. Yeah, you ever notice he's got a head like MODOK? Really, get him one of those little chairs and he'll float around the convention.
So, Bob, do you do any impressions?
Well, everybody has heard Mike. He's got a certain syntax. I mean, everybody, you start talking like him, Yeah. He does this thing with the head. Yeah. MODOK.
I don't know what to follow that up. Does anybody have any questions?
About MODOK.
MODOK? Pete, what time are we running at here?
It's a quarter to one.
Quarter to one. I have no idea when this is supposed to end up. I assume somebody will come. Pardon?
1 o'clock.
1 o'clock? Okay. So we've got time for a couple more stories. And
well, I want to tee up a story that I haven't heard in 20 years, but you were asked by a television company to do an interview once. Could you, it wasn't me.
No, it was in France.
It was in France with the chainsaws.
Yeah, I'd done Hard Boiled and, you know, this was, you know, the 90s and the punk thing and all this, and they invited me to come and do this interview for this TV station. And I went, and I showed up, and I go in the door, and they said, yes. I said, well, I'm here for an interview. They go, who are you? I said, Jeff Darrow. I said, you're Jeff Darrow? Because I, you know, look fairly straight. I mean, you know, and they thought I was going to have all these piercings, and I'd have tattoos, and they thought I'd be this crazy, because they came, and they go, you're Jeff Darrow? I said, yeah. They go, yeah, but you look so normal. And I said, sorry. We're going to make you up. We're going to do something. We're going to make up so it looks like your throat is cut. And they're going to put this prosthesis on me. So I do this interview. I've got my throat cut. And I said, whoa, whoa, whoa. I said, you know, are you paying me to be an actor here? Because if you're going to put, you're going to have to pay me. I just came to do an interview. I'm not here to perform. And he said, so you don't want to have the throat cut? I said, okay. So then we go into the other room, and I can hear, because I don't think they think I can speak French well. I think, he's not going to do the throat cut. So we go into the room, and they've got on this table a pig head, two of them, two pig heads, and a chainsaw. And as this is the interview, we will ask you questions, and while you're answering them, you will be cutting up the pig heads with the chainsaw. And I said, I'm not going to do that. And they said, why not? They said, what, you want to interview me, or is this some sort of a performance art thing? Because you're not paying me to do that. I said, that's embarrassing. And they said, well, what do you do? They said, well, you know, it doesn't make any sense. Yes, but you're drawing just so violent. And I said, yeah, but I don't. I'm not going to do it. I said, if you want me to pretend to sharpen a pencil with a chainsaw, it makes a little sense. But they go, okay, so they're doing the interview, and everybody coming in and out of the room going, why is he cutting up the pig heads? He won't cut up the pig heads. Why not? He says he wants to do that. So when it was over, I mean, they're supposed to take me to the train station. They said, goodbye. And so I had to find my way back to the train to go back to Paris. And you know, and I never did see the thing. I don't know where they aired it or, but, yeah, the pig head story.
Probably had somebody else in kind of.
Yeah, they probably made more sense than me.
Somebody should look for that on YouTube. It's out there.
They probably filmed you from here up, and they had hands with their hands going.
I mean, I didn't even know how to use a chainsaw. Actually, I was more afraid of hurting myself than. I had an uncle. Cut his leg off of the chainsaw. Of course, he was probably drunk. This guy's amazing. This guy, he goes into an alcoholic coma, and he's, you know, the doctors come in, he's brain dead. You know, he'll never, if he ever comes out of it, he'll be a vegetable. And they're going to have to turn the machine off. You know, you can't keep this. The guy's gone. And his kids won't do it. And I'm like, they're being selfish. They'll feel bad because they weren't around when he was, he's had all these problems. Hey, the guy's, dead. I mean, he's just a vegetable. It's me to leave him go. And like 2 days later, the guy wakes up and he's perfectly normal. And he's driving, he bought himself a new red car and he's driving it down. I would have killed the guy. I'd have turned him off. It's like, whoops. And I never said my dad would be like, looking at me like, don't let him in the hospital.
Does anybody else have any last questions before we wrap up here? Anyway.
None about MODOK.
Cricket. Oh, yes.
Right.
Do you have any favorite moments or stories of stuff that came up on the job, whether it's good or bad? Just got any bad experiences with some of the people, but
Let's start with you, Bob, if you've got one.
I've been drawing comics for 35 years. There's so many, like, it'd be hard to just come up with one off the top of my head. I'd need some kind of reference. Nothing springs to mind, really.
So do you have any, like, what career highlights?
I can tell you one thing. I started out in Neil Adams' studio, Continuity Studios. Everybody familiar with Neil's Continuity Studios? Anybody? He had this studio where a whole lot of artists would work in little offices and do their own projects and then sometimes work on his projects. He and Dick Giordano were a team and would get all these advertising jobs and commercial comic jobs and just regular comic jobs. And he was Neil Adams. He was like, at the time I got into comics in the 70s, the single most important artist in the business, pretty much. Joe Kubert, maybe, John Buscema, but Neil was kind of the young all-star. Just everybody was blown away by Neil. So he was pretty full of himself. And the guys in the studio used to try to bring him down a little bit. So one time I did a cartoon of Neil. Neil was famous for eating junk food and snacks and Twinkies and putting on some weight. He used to be a really thin, good-looking guy, but over the years he just kept putting on the pounds. So I do this cartoon of him with his arms out like this and his legs out and his big belly. And I started out doing caricatures, so I was able to get a good likeness of Neil. And we put it up on the dartboard at Continuity. And we put a little Twinkie behind the drawing so that if you hit him right in the stomach, this cream would ooze out. So we were there tossing darts at the dartboard with Neil's picture on it, and all of a sudden he came up in the elevator with his kids. We all scattered. Just took off. So his little boy said, "Daddy, is that you?"
Jeff, any last anecdotes you'd like to impart before we head out?
A little Hanna-Barbera story.
Sure.
At least Hanna-Barbera never—they did everything. They kept doing it over and over and over. There was no reason to draw because there were characters on. There was never any reason to draw another thing because you just go to this file and they kept it. You know, you look up pig, and they got drawings of pigs in various styles, and I got into this thing where I would go in there and take out model sheets and. I'd leave the original in there, but I'd alter them just for gags because we'd get so bored. And one of the things was, like, I ran across one for Super Friends, which was the Batman show, and it was a guy on a gurney. And he's just a guy with a sheet over him. And I went in and I took it and I gave the guy on the gurney the sheet. He must have taken some Viagra because he had a very noticeable tent situation going on the gurney. And I wrote I kept exactly the same logo, and it was Super Friends, and used to be an actor named John Holmes, who was well known for having the largest. And it said John Holmes is Super Friend, and I put that back in the model thing. And not every once in a while, TV practice would go in to check stuff, and they found that in there, and they were certain that it had made it on the air because it looked just like all the other stuff. So they had this witch hunt to find out, you know, who had put that in the show. And
did they find you?
I mean, I was always the last guy hired and the first guy left because it was a seasonal business. And, you know, they go, and like, that guy that hated me was always like, you know, he'd see me there every year for about 4 or 5 months working. He goes, "What did you do last year?" Because I was working on Richie Rich or Super Friends. "Oh, really? Okay." So, yeah, a lot of that stuff, a lot of hijinks. We had this one guy, this one artist, really kind of a cantankerous guy. And they had, in the men's room, they had the, paper toilet seat covers that you could take. And I took a box of them, and I drew this guy's face on every one. So every time someone would go in there, they'd be... you know, you hear this guy, "God damn it! What the hell?" He knew it was me. He had a pretty good sense of humor. really great artist. That's it.
Well, I'd like to thank you both for coming and doing the panel.
Thank you.
Everybody would give them a round of applause. They will both be returning to their table. Maybe not!
Classic spit take.
In the main convention hall. For those of you wondering, since I didn't actually say it, my name is Brent Chittenden. I write for Comic Book Daily. We also have a table. Feel free to come over and say hi.
Thank you. Thank you.